All right. Thank you, Domati Pongo. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG. And a lot to talk about. We're going to talk to Roger Chang from CNET in the second half hour about the drones, the fuel efficiency of drones. It's not what you might think. There's a study, and they do better in California than they do in Missouri. We'll talk to Roger about that. But we start on an occasional Thursday with Dennis Rodkin, who writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, on a phone line with us now. Dennis, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, you know, I just realized I don't have time to talk to you about everything I want to talk about. I just remembered I wanted
Should
to
I
talk
know?
To you. No. Okay. Well, let's start with rent control, because in the upcoming primary ballot, several precincts in Chicago are going to have a chance to vote on whether or not they want rent control. Most of them, or the biggest, or the most concentrated chunk, I would say, is in the Pilsen neighborhood, where they have a real gentrification problem.
Yes. So in Illinois, rent control has been prohibited by state law since 1997. And Pilsen is one of the places where there's been a lot of gentrification, a lot of rent increases, and people are saying, well, should the city be allowed to at least consider rent control? So one of the things to be aware of with this referendum is it's only advisory. It's on the ballot in about 4% of the precincts in the city, and what people are going to be able to vote on is not do we get rent control, but do we want the city or individual cities, not only Chicago, to have control over whether they decide on rent control rather than having this statewide prohibition? This is sort of sponsored or promoted by a group called the Lift the Ban Coalition. Nobody's yet saying, here's what form rent control would take in Chicago. It's just, can you put this tool back in the hands of Chicago, as well as Aurora, Springfield, and other municipalities.
So, you know, and if you're a landlord, obviously you don't want your hands tied like this. You'd like to increase rent with the market. But I read in your story that one of the things that the bill, that an eventual deal might allow, would be a change in rent when it comes to changing in tenants. But maybe you just couldn't go to some family who's been living in an apartment for 15 years and double their rent because you could get it from someone new.
Yeah, and that's what the concern is that a lot of these activist groups have is, I've been living in this apartment for years, and suddenly the neighborhood, the dynamics in the neighborhood are changing, and you're able to jack up my rent because of what the market is doing. And what these organizations say is, shouldn't there be some deference paid to the fact that I've been in this apartment
sure.
for a very long time? So that would all be, you know, what would be the components of rent control would be a whole mess of issues that would come after the lifting of the ban.
It sort of is a different version of the old folks who are being property taxed out of their home.
Yeah, exactly. It's the very same thing.
Okay, right. Let's go to Buffalo Grove. I really, until I was introducing you, I forgot we wanted to talk a couple weeks ago about Chinese real estate company that located their first office ever in the U.S., and they picked Buffalo Grove. It was a great story. People, you should go back to chicagobusiness.com and find it. But explain for me who these people are and why they're here.
Well, it's interesting. They're a Chinese-based firm. And what their Chinese name essentially means is, I love my home. They're called 5i5j, based in China. And their idea is, there is a lot of money coming out of China into U.S. real estate, less than there was before. However, people in China who want to buy in this country, either investment property or property they would move here to live in, are very likely to be looking near the best schools. I talked to a few people who said top schools would be the primary attribute they would look at. So this company, starting its business in the United States, started near Stevenson High School, which is Illinois' best high school.
They might have picked anywhere in the U.S., but they choose Buffalo Grove because of the students there, because the kids would go to Stevenson High School.
Right. Well, it's sort of a 1-2. They chose the Chicago area because Chicago's prices are still so much lower than other big cities. And within the Chicago area, they chose Stevenson because of the quality of the high school.
All right, that's Dennis Rodkin. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go from Buffalo Grove to Palos Park. He's got a great story about a house there. We're talking to Dennis Rodkin, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, on a phone line on this Thursday afternoon. Okay, I suspect you really enjoyed writing this story about Lawrence and Constance Riley in Palos Park. Am I right?
Yeah, I did, Steve. It was, I was picturing this family on picnics in the 50s, driving out from Lawndale to Palos Park with a right. basket full of sandwiches, and the whole family's working on the house.
The kids probably didn't really want to go because they were going to be working.
They didn't. So let's say that this is a house in Palos Park where the family of eight, father, mother, and eight kids, as well as uncles, aunts, neighbors, all pitched in to hand build their house in Palos Park. They were moving out from the city. It took them about 16 years. They moved in about 8 years into the process. They were moving from Lawndale in the city. They physically hand built the house themselves to the father's design, and they just sold it. They moved in 1961, and they just sold it this month. The parents have both died.
It's a dream, right? It's the dad's dream. He wanted a nice suburban home, so he had, what was it, about an acre that he could buy in Palos Park, and just knew over time that he was going to relocate his family there.
Yeah, and apparently it was the father's dream. It was not, as you intimated, the children's dream. One of them, who went on to become an architect, who built houses in the south suburbs, said he had to, that while he was in high school, at Sandberg High School, helping to build the house, he couldn't do sports, he couldn't do other activities, because he had to be home helping work on the house. His name is Philip Riley. He, as I said, is a prominent architect in the south suburbs. So, yeah, it was dad's dream, and the family now talks about it as, you know, we had a good time together, we bonded. But Philip Riley, this son, was able to say, but at the time, I really didn't enjoy the experience.
You write that it takes on this sort of, it's a great example of mid-century building, but the guy just made it up.
Yeah, he was apparently a fan of Frank Lloyd Wright, and there is a staircase that looks a lot like the staircase that Frank Lloyd Wright designed for Falling Water in Pennsylvania. But he was a salesman of industrial brick. He liked architecture, and he essentially conceived of this himself. It has this sort of overbuilt steel frame. It apparently is built to support far more than the weight it does support.
Yeah.
but it's a great looking house. It's built like a ship, and it essentially looks a little bit like a boat because it sits up on this hillside with a big deck around the upper floor. And it's sort of a Brady Bunch style house, not
right.
the same look, but that wonderful sort of mid-century feeling. Lots of great original touches are still in there. The linoleum and these wonderful brick screens and things. It's pretty cool.
Let's hear it for Lawrence Riley and Constance, who put up with it year after year. Okay, another thing we talk about a lot, and we've only got a minute or so here, but is the housing, the shortage of houses on the market. I was reading a story that you wrote this week about that, and you made a reference to a couple of things, and I want to focus on this, that sometimes homes aren't getting on the market because they're sold before they get to the MLS listings. And you talk about pocket listings, and there was another one, like an in-home selling. I can't find the other term now. Pocket listings.
Yeah, and
pre-market.
And a few other agencies have essentially an in-house app where...
Or pre-market sales, too.
Pre-market sales, yeah. An in-house app and pre-market where I, as an agent, have something coming on the market, and before it's fully ready, before we've painted the master bedroom to get rid of the ugly wallpaper, that sort of thing, I can let you, another at properties or another agent in our brokerage, know about it, and your clients might get in before it's officially on the market.
You suggest, too, that buyers rely on their realtors, and the realtors are sending, I get these postcards in the mail from realtors trying to coax me into selling my house. So they're trying to, they're sort of recruiting inventory rather than waiting for inventory to show up.
Yeah, in this market, especially for the first time buyer, the under $350,000 sort of part of the market where the inventory is tightest, there's a lot of prospecting being done by agents where they're going out and saying, my buyer's lost out on a multi-bid situation on a three-bedroom house down the block that was $350,000. Yours looks like it would be pretty similar. Are you looking
right.
like you're ready to sell? Which makes it easier for that seller because they may not end up having to, again, paint the master bedroom, do all those things, if they know they have a buyer essentially on the line. Some of those postcards are just prospecting blind, but a lot of agents are getting pretty aggressive about saying, we just saw this sell. You are just like it. Are you interested?
That's Dennis Rodkin. Read more at chicagobusiness.com. Dennis, great to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, thank you, Del Matisse, Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG and 1238 on this Thursday afternoon. Roger Chang is on the phone line. He is a senior news editor at CNET, and Roger joins us from time to time. Roger, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, always happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I want to. You wrote this piece that caught my attention about 5G, so I want to get to that in a couple of minutes. But I was telling everyone I was going to talk to you first about Amazon and drones and the fuel economy of using drones. Pretty interesting story. I think Axios founded first this study in Nature Communications, but it looked at whether using drones, and they used Amazon, but whether using drones for delivery could actually cut down on carbon emissions. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the idea that like these drones are smaller, they're definitely more power efficient, they're not emitting greenhouse gas like large delivery trucks. So you just sort of take that logically, like a fleet of these drones might actually be more efficient and more environmentally friendly than the traditional means of having a large truck carrying tons of different packages.
Which is obvious, I guess, and makes perfect sense. But then they looked further and looked at where particular states got a majority of their energy. So in California, where a lot of it is clean energy in the first place, it would have a bigger impact than, say, in Missouri, which relies on fossil fuel energy to create electricity that would be used to charge the drone. So it wouldn't be as efficient, say, in Missouri as in California.
Definitely. It's not a blanket solution, but definitely there are pockets in the country where drone deliveries can actually be more environmentally friendly. I mean, obviously, we're still a ways away from drones.
Well, I was going to ask you, yeah, how close are we?
The fact of the matter is that there aren't any real laws yet regulating how drones can be used in this way, so not for a while.
You know, I belong to the Dollar Shave Club. Well, that's a perfect example. So every month I get, a big cardboard envelope with a 2-inch packet of razors in it. right? It's a lot of paper to create that, to wrap it. A guy has to drive to my door and walk it up. Seems like something like that would eventually be a perfect possibility for UPS or FedEx or whomever to use a drone or Amazon to get it to my door.
Yeah, you can imagine with the drone, they'd have to design these packages to be a little bit smaller. I had the same problem. I just ordered a bunch of kids' toothbrushes. It was four of them, and they came in this giant cardboard box. And I'm like, why? And, just sort of stare there. You scratch your head for a while to figure out why the packaging.
That's the story. The box companies must just be taking off these days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Ian Schur comes by usually on Thursdays. We talk to him, and we've been following the Apple HomePod for a while, and the fact that they've been behind Amazon and others. And finally, the Apple HomePod comes out. They're charging a lot, right? I think it's like $350, and come to find out, it needs a coaster.
Yeah, so it turns out the silicone base that's basically there to absorb vibrations from the speaker. It doesn't work well with wooden surfaces. Apparently, it interacts with the wood, leaves a little white mark, a little white ring around basically where the silicone is. Not so great if you spend a ton of money on this thing. Now, the good news is usually the white rings can be wiped off, and they suggest using, as you said, a coaster of some sort or taking it off of a wood surface. Completely.
I mean, sometimes you make a mistake, and it's okay if your gin and tonic leaves a white ring. But I don't think if you're paying $350 that they should have improved the design a little bit.
Yeah, look, this is an unforeseen issue with Apple. It's important to note that another company, Sonos, there's reports that their speaker company as well, that some of their speakers also leave white marks. You can imagine, so the same kind of silicone base that's being used there has the same issue. I have an Echo speaker. I'm going to go home and see if it's left any marks on my wooden nightstand.
I do too, and it's I don't think mine's on wood, so I think I'm safe there. But it just sort of Apple's interesting because they're not always first. Sometimes they come up from behind and try to improve on what's already been created. But it just seems like with the HomePod, they've had some real trouble.
Yeah, I mean, between the delays and between the fact that you can't really use it for anything else beyond Apple Music and its own services, there are definitely some challenges with the home.
All right, so you wrote a piece on 5G, and we've been talking about the fact that it's coming, and you sort of wrote a glossary, which I love, but explain for me, you know, explain for me 5G and why it's going to be sort of more all-encompassing than 3 or 4G.
All right, so 5G is, as its name suggests, the fifth generation of cellular technology. It's supposed to be significantly faster, 10 to 100 times faster than what we're getting right now. It's supposed to be more comprehensive, as well as more power efficient, both for carriers to offer the service and for devices. So it's not just about getting higher speeds on your phone. It's really about connecting everything. You know, there's this, the terminology Internet of Things, this idea of connecting all these formerly dumb products.
Yeah, right.
Washing machine, your car, your toaster. The idea is like this network is cheap enough and efficient enough that you'll be able to connect anything to it. And it's really seen as sort of the foundational tech for a lot of things, like self-driving cars. The idea of 5G, one of the key benefits of 5G is something called low latency, the idea that there's almost zero lag between, you know, when you ping the network and when you get a response. And for something like self-driving cars, where you need to have very, very real-time sensors and information flowing everywhere, stuff like 5G is critical for that.
All right, so if by any chance you are facing a vocabulary test when it comes to 5G, check out CNET.com or search Roger Cheng, and you can see all of it explained there. Roger, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Minute, sharing the news and asking questions for small business owners. It's flu season, and this year is like no other, but workers and employers don't seem to be taking it too seriously. Researchers are comparing this year's outbreak to 2009, where 8 million people went to work sick, infecting an additional 7 million people. So employers, provide sick leave insurance, and employees, stay home if you're sick. Healthy people are happy people, except one unhappy Illinois man. He is suing L.L. Bean for changing their endless return policy, claiming it's not what shoppers bargained for. L.L. Bean is changing this policy after over the years realizing they've lost over $250 million in abused product returns. This begs the question, is the customer always right? Tune in tomorrow for all your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Thanks, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, 1250 on this Thursday afternoon. Elise Glink is in the studio. You know Elise as the publisher of ThinkGlink.com and the force behind Best Money Moves. That's that HR app that talks about stress in the workplace, helping to identify it, and then giving employers the tools to help their employees cope. Right?
Right.
Hey, let's talk stress.
Sure. You look a little stressed today.
I'm always stressed, you know, and I will get to that. But you had a blog post up just today, I think, about the stress that women are facing and how dealing with women's stress, if mama ain't stressed, ain't none of us stressed. Is that the point of the column?
I think it might be in the very short version. So I published this on Shortlister today. Shortlister is kind of a database. They're based in Park Ridge, a local company. They do a lot of online work with companies and consultants in the benefits industry. And they asked me to write something about women, money, and stress. So three things that I know a lot about. Because, you know, as I've been doing all this research for Best Money Moves, it occurs to me that, you know, if women have workplace stress, like with Me Too and inherent sexism, you know, causing them not to get the kind of promotions or money that they deserve, and at home they're still doing more of the work than their spouses or partners, and now they feel financial stress differently, and in some ways even more strongly than their male counterparts. When you add that together, that's a pretty stressed out workforce.
And so if you can deal with your stressed out female workforce, that will help your office in general.
I think so. I mean, this may end up being more controversial than I thought it was. and it's not saying that the guys out there aren't also stressed.
No,
I am not saying that at all. All I'm saying is that women are now about parity in the workforce, and the stress that they feel isn't just about financial stress.
So, and I'm sorry if I made you feel that it's controversial.
And I
will not be confrontational, but sometimes I get a little defensive, and I don't mean to be that either.
It's okay.
because I'm, so there's two things. There's general, there's societal, maybe, and then there's individual. Because my wife has a full-time job. She does do more at home than I do. And I am so much more stressed out than she is. So
just in general?
Just in general, I am.
Okay.
So I think sometimes, I don't know what that says, but I tend to be more so.
Do you think maybe she hides her stress from you because it would stress even more?
No. When she lets out steam, man, you should see it. maybe, I don't know. But I guess my point is that even if someone does have all those external factors coming on, it doesn't mean that she is less stressed than men.
No,
in her life.
I think that, you know, so at an there's an individual level, and then there's all the research, right? So research looks at large groups of people, and the individual looks at kind of you and me,
right,
and what we do in our daily lives. And so people who are wandering around listening to this may go, well, in my life, that's not the case, like you. And in my life, it may not be the case. But when you look at the research and how women are coping in the workforce, you see the bubbling up of Me Too, you realize that there's a hidden and untapped loud voice that is starting to break through. And my contention is it's not, you know, Me Too and everything going on in workplace stress, workplace sexism stress, is layered on with these other stressors. And that's why helping solve that for women, and I think Me Too and workplace sexism is really in the purview of women, but solving for some of these stressors together is going to help everybody overall in the workforce.
I want to get to this, to the solving in a second, but one more pass at this. Then if those are characteristic stresses for women, there must also be characteristic stresses for men, right, that are outside of those?
I'm certainly that there are. So when we look at Best Money Moves and some of the detail that comes back to us, you know, I was just out in Denver last week talking with our couple of our customers and their people. And so a bunch of the guys were in the focus groups and talking to them about, you know, the stress that they feel. And they feel stress acutely, financial stress acutely. What they don't seem to feel is the other two pieces of it.
Right, right.
But financial stress is something that companies can identify and solve for in their employees. And as I've said to you before on the air, companies are losing $250 billion a year just to financial stress.
Okay, so that will conclude my 2 minutes of explaining how hard it is to be a white man.
Privilege is hard.
I didn't need all that time. All right, so female stress, women's stress in the workplace, what do you do about it?
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, in this blog post, I said there are a couple of different things that you can do that really help. One is to initiate rewards and recognition programs. And while, you know, we come from this era where everybody's like, oh, we want to have a badge, we want to be rewarded. One of the things we've learned with Best Money Moves is we can't have enough ways for people to earn points in the system. They just want points for point's sake.
Like apps where you get, you know, walk 100 flights, I get an app on my Fitbit.
Exactly. You want a little badge for it.
And that works.
That works.
Wow.
And they told us in no uncertain terms, add more ways for us to earn points. But there are some great technologies out there that companies can adopt for that are really focused on reward and recognition. And they use technology and kind of cool machine learning or intelligent design to surface people who are doing all the hard work but not getting recognized for it.
And acknowledge that the financial stress is there, I would imagine, is a big part of it.
It is. And so, and we know it's pervasive, right? Most people don't have $400 in cash. So
the problem is that you can't just put up a poster and say, oh, you know, we're facing, right? Because it's a personal thing.
It is very personal, except that you would be surprised. So employees, this is new, right? In the last 3, 4, 5 years, employees have started to turn to their employers for trusted information around money and all these topics relating to personal finance, which is one of the reasons we designed Best Money Moves to do that.
And they do that at a time when there's more individual responsibility for their financial, right?
Correct.
I mean, it used to be you turn to your company for your pension, and mm-hmm. You're on your own now for that.
Yeah.
And yet they're going back to the company to get help with it.
They need help because they've got other issues as well. You know, companies are struggling with healthcare costs. Companies are struggling with other kinds of needing to compete with a tight job market. This is a way for them to, another way to help reduce the stress if they can't give everybody $500,000 a year.
Elise Gling from thinklink.com. I'm calmer now.
I'm so glad.
You've helped me.
Great.
Let's hold hands and do some meditation.
Kumbaya.